For a new day and a new week, thank you for this privilege we have of being here together, of worshiping you later. We're grateful for that privilege every week. Pray that you bless our time now, that you would give us clarity, and that we'd be able to understand how this branch of your church functions. We ask it in Christ. Amen. All right, it dawned on me after we were done last week that I skipped over. I intended to go from the function of the session to the function of the diaconate, you know, those kind of local boards, but I jumped from there to the presbytery. So let's go back and pick up the diaconate. The office of the deacon is described in chapter 9 of the Book of Order, and it is a it is to be a our understanding anyway a perpetual office. The church ought to have. Ought to have deacons. It's not just for a certain period of time that you have some deacons to do something and then they go away or something. No, they should always be there. And it's to be focused on sympathy and service. Now, we point to the complaint that arose there in Acts when the Greek widows weren't being properly served and they appointed seven men to deal with the daily distribution of food and that sort of thing. Now, in that particular passage, they're not necessarily called deacons, but then later we find that word in Timothy and Titus, and if they weren't deacons, what were they? I guess is the question. So that connection has been made. In chapter 9, article 2, we read, "It is the duty of the deacon to minister to those who are in need, to the sick, to the friendless, and to any who may be in distress. It is their duty also to develop the grace of liberality in the members of the church, to devise effective methods of collecting the gifts of the people, and to distribute these gifts among the objects to which they are to be contributed. They shall have the care of the property of the congregation, both real and personal," and it goes on to talk about some of those things. What happens in the average PCA church? I mean, the way it's written there, sympathy and service, and then a number of other lines there describing how that's supposed to happen. So that's the major. Major part of the job. Steroids. then what happens in the average PCA church, under there a lesser function, that of property. The church building, taking care of the roof and that sort of stuff. In every church I've served in, and most of the others that I hear about, those get flipped. That the deacons are looked to paint the ceiling, to fix the roof, to cut down the trees like they did the other week, that sort of thing, and the sympathy and service becomes the lesser function. And I think that's just not good. One thing that gets overlooked almost all the time. It is their duty to develop the grace of liberality in the members of the church. So the function of the deacon then, there is one to the whole congregation, that they would be in, and it doesn't describe how they go about that, but they need to be encouraging us and giving us good reasons to be giving, whether. I mean, again, it doesn't say whether that's specifically to a, quote, deacon's fund, but certainly that would be a huge part of it. Now, we are starting to get some of that functioning, but we haven't done all that well. The focus of our deacons, just like just about everybody else's, has been on the issues of property. Now, some churches, in order to try and keep the deacon's focus here, they have another board called trustees that answer to the deacons, but they are, or some may call them a building and grounds committee or something like that too, where they're not necessarily, there may be a couple of deacons that serve on it, but the board as such is not part of the diaconate, and they take care of those, you know, buildings and grounds kinds of issues so that the deacon's focus can be on the needs of the people and that sort of thing. Now, there's a good question and a worthy debate, which I don't necessarily want to enter into today, on the function of the deacon relative to what might be called mercy. By that, I mean people of the community, people outside of the local congregation. It's clear that the diaconal sympathy and service is certainly directed to people in the church. And if you recall, even Paul, when he traveled about and taking collections, those collections weren't to provide hurricane relief or earthquake relief somewhere. It was for the distressed believers back in Israel who were being ostracized and losing their jobs and that sort of thing because they confessed Christ. So that's there's no debate on that the deacons function relative to the believers in this congregation and then perhaps extending out to believers elsewhere. But we get numerous calls from someone in the community. Do you help with BGE notices? Do you help with eviction notices and that sort of thing? Recently, we have done that. We have given aid. Recently, we've declined everyone because we have a number of folks in our congregation that are kind of teetering on the financial edge. We want to keep what's in our fund in order to be able to help them as the need arises. There are other churches with enormous mercy ministry issues, and giving away, tens of thousands of dollars a year to people in the community. I'm not denying that the church ought to have a mercy ministry. I question whether or not it's a diaconal function. Now, there are plenty throughout the PCA that would wholeheartedly disagree with me on that, and I'm not firm and solid on it. I just wonder, is that what the deacons are for? Tim Keller wrote a book about deacons. I think it was perhaps his first book before he became big time famous guy. But a great bulk of the book is just describing and explaining how to get a mercy ministry going. So there are large questions there on how that all should happen, and the function again of the office is one of It's a spiritual office, although they deal with, nuts and bolts, dollars and cents kinds of things relative to people. But that's not the only thing. Those who are in need, to the sick, to the friendless, and any who may be in distress. So, it would be a good function of the deacon to visit someone who's lonely, for instance. So it's not just distributing funds to those who, excuse me, who can't pay their bills, but that sympathy and service kind of function across the board in terms of the church. And the book goes on to say that they're to be functioning as a board, and they shall have a chairman and a secretary. And that kind of stuff. Now they do have the function of we don't do it that well here. Maybe one of the reasons is we're so small. But in a large church, the deacons would have the monthly oversight of the budget. And they would keep tracking with, okay, this ministry or that committee or whatever, you've overspent your budget, you know, up to the point that we are in the year, you need to back off and that kind of stuff. You know, we don't have a whole lot that needs to be tracked. Well, the way it works, the deacons prepare. They prepare the budget, but then that has to be approved by the session. So it's not the budget for the year until the session approves it. But then throughout the year, the deacons track it. But if someone needs, let's say you have a certain ministry and they've blown their budget by June. If someone needs more money to function for the rest of the year, that would have to come back around to session to be approved. So it's another one of those check and balance kinds of things. And the deacons, in order to free up the session from the nuts and bolts examination of what's going on with the budget, the deacons are to do that and then report to the session on how we're doing. The way we're set up, the session is pretty much still doing that tracking of the budget. It's on our agenda for every month. So I'd like to move away from that a little bit if we could, but doesn't look like it's happening anytime soon. So yeah. Okay, any questions on the diaconate? Well, we haven't. I think we've been a bit delinquent, actually, as a session on. I mean, when we first started, we had no deacons at all, so the session functioned as the diaconate. And then after the first year, we had one deacon, and then two. So we're still sort of getting our act together. But no.
I mean, not that you want a lay person doing all the hospital visitation. Right.
And ideally, that is the case. Now, for instance, I don't know how lots of churches work, but 10th Presbyterian in Philadelphia, I'm not sure how many members they have, but probably well over 1,000. They've divided their congregation into what they call parishes. And I believe each parish has a ruling elder and two deacons assigned to it. And I was talking to one of the guys a good friend of mine was on part-time staff there. And he said, most of the time, if a pastor does go visit, they've already, you know, the deacon or the ruling elder or somebody in that parish has already beat him to it, or a number of people that are in that parish have been, you know, so they've put it together. It's working really well. The people feel, you know, majorly connected if something's going on. And usually, once the church office is notified or something, it comes from one of the leaders of that of that parish. You know, they're calling the office saying, "Hey, so and so is in the hospital or something."
The other thing that happens in the bigger churches is you have a church staff. You know, you have your minister to youth and your minister, you know, and those people, as well as the pastor, do all the stuff that the deacons could or should be doing.
No, I think the way it is explained here would certainly call for that kind of function. How well that works in most of our churches, I would doubt that it's very well at all. But that is our theoretical understanding of the office. How it's actually played out in reality is different. Okay. Any other thoughts or questions on deacons? All right, let's roll on then to last week we talked about the session in the presbytery. Let's talk about the General Assembly. This would be the national governing body. The General Assembly isn't just the United States. It covers the PCA. We have churches also in Canada. We have one church in Grand Cayman. But other churches that have been planted by Mission to the World, for instance, in other countries, are connected to denominations in those countries, like the Reformed Church of France, or the we had a huge operation in Mexico City for a number of years, and all of those churches are part of the Presbyterian Church of Mexico. But we were just helping them, you know, do church planting and that sort of thing. So generally, churches that would consider themselves, you know, North American, are under the General Assembly and part of the PCA. The assembly meets officially once a year, usually for 4 days. Well, they say 4 days, but I always leave the night before because we always get done early. Wasn't always that way. Back in the early 80s. I forget the exact year, 82, 83, something like that. The Reformed Presbyterian Church Evangelical Synod, which was a strong denomination in this area, joined the PCA. It was called JNR, Joining and Receiving. Those assemblies, I remember we had one in Philadelphia, and we had to be out of there by noon. We were meeting in the Academy of Music. Noon on Friday, we had to leave. So we were there. I think till 3:30 Friday morning till we took our break. You know, it's like, because there was just way too much business. It was fascinating. There was a guy, this has nothing to do with anything, but a guy out in Ohio or Western Pennsylvania or something, somewhere out there, had two issues. He was ordained, but his ordination was challenged and complained against by the presbytery, or by someone in the presbytery, and he appealed it to the General Assembly, and somewhere around 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning, the assembly ruled to sustain the complaint. So he at 1:30 or 2, he lost his job. But there were a couple hundred of us that signed a protest, and that so moved one of the guys that voted with the assembly earlier. He moved reconsideration. We reconsidered, and like 10 of 3 or something, he got his job back. So that was a crazy night. But anyway, the assemblies recently have been extremely peaceful. We're always done early. And we've restructured things considerably over the last couple of years to make them work better. The assembly is in a sense of graded courts. Your session is local, the presbytery is regional. This is national, and in that sense, is the highest court. Although that court does not generally dictate stuff down, other than things that have already arisen down here, go there for approval, and then come back down. They don't generate their own stuff for the most part. the assembly has major committees that do the work of the church. Those committees are, they conduct work throughout the year because the assembly isn't meeting all year, so these committees carry out that work. Christian Ed and Publication, so all the materials, Sunday school materials and that sort of stuff that come out from the denomination come from that committee. Now, that committee is connected also to Great Commission Publications, which is a combined effort between the PCA and the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. The Trinity Hymnal, for instance, comes from Great Commission Publication, which is a dual effort. Covenant College is one of the committees. Covenant Theological Seminary. PCA Retirement and Benefits, that is what it says it is. Mission to North America, that's the church planting arm here at home. Mission to the World, it's one of the largest mission organizations around. The PCA Foundation, it's a financial deal where you can, there's actually literature out there, you can give money to the foundation and they can hold it or disperse it for you. For instance, if you wanted to give anonymously to a certain missionary or to a certain ministry, it's higher level financial stuff ways for pretty much wealthier people to structure some of their giving. Ridgehaven Conference Center, it is our denominational center, but it's used largely regionally. It's down in the mountains of it's near Asheville, North Carolina. I've never been there. And then Reformed University Ministries is our campus ministry around the country. So those are the ministry committees. Now we also have a standing judicial commission, and there is a theological examination committee, and I'll talk about those in a bit. The assembly also has a nominating committee to nominate people for these various committees when the assembly meets, so that functions. The theological examination committee examines anyone who's going to serve on a permanent committee to make sure that they're acceptable to the church. So all of, and certain employees of the of the denomination also have, for instance, the stated clerk. If the same guy gets reelected year after year, he doesn't have to be re-examined. But if a new guy comes in, he needs to be examined by the theological examination committee. The assembly functions on a number of levels. One, to carry out the Great Commission through Mission of the World, Mission North America, Covenant College, Covenant Seminary, that sort of thing. So it's the largest function of the church relative to the whole world, and comes down from that highest court. The it also functions through the we'll just call it the SJC, the Standing Judicial Commission. That's the highest court of appeal in the denomination. We've had a few this past year from our own presbyter here go up to the SJC. There was a situation of a guy, his wife left him. He challenged that before his local session. No, it's a guy in the congregation. He went to the session and basically brought charges against her. The session did not find a strong presumption of guilt. Basically, they were saying she had justifiable reasons for leaving him. He then complained to the session against that action. The session denied his complaint. That complaint then, he bumped it up to the presbytery. Presbytery denied his complaint. He took it to the Standing Judicial Commission. They denied his complaint. Once that happens, he's done. I mean, there's no higher level to go to. The way this functions, we don't. See, back in those early years, that 2 o'clock in the morning thing, we had no such commission. All appeals and everything else had to be tried by the assembly of 1,000 guys sitting there, and it was just so incredibly cumbersome. So we established this, and if they rule unanimously, nothing else can be said. The assembly has no. Now you can protest. You can bellyache, but it's done. I mean, nothing's going to happen. If there's a sizable majority, I don't remember precisely what those numbers were. But if a minority report comes out from the commission, then that can be voted on by the assembly. But it's there's no debate. You know, it's put out there. You vote it up or down. Correct. He wanted them to find a strong presumption of guilt against her for leaving him.
Okay, and that was simply so he wouldn't be unjustified. I'm trying to understand how something like that, which, you know, in our modern society is considered strange that someone would bring that to before a Protestant denomination.
Well, I mean, it would be our belief, I mean, even in the confession, it says that it ought not to be entered into lightly or unadvisedly or something like that, and the church needs to be involved in that decision. So, you know, if the day came that you decided to divorce Sarah, you ought not just go ahead and do it. You need to come in and get the church's ruling on whether or not you have sufficient grounds to do so. Okay.
Does the church have a position on remarriage?
My understanding of the PCA's view, if there is a legitimate divorce, if there are legitimate grounds for that divorce, then remarriage is acceptable. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, the assembly also, it's an interesting process. This book, it's loose leaf, and that's for a reason, because it changes every year. So the way the book gets changed, it usually begins. Often it begins with a session where they find something in the book, and they say we ought to change that. So they bring it to the presbytery. If the presbytery approves it, then it becomes an overture to the General Assembly, and we have overtures every year on changing one item or another in the book. When if the assembly approves that overture, then it goes back down to all of the presbyteries, and there has to be a majority. I forget if it's a simple majority or two thirds. I think it's two thirds of all the presbyteries vote, you know, as individual presbyteries vote to approve or disapprove. If it's approved by the presbyteries, it comes back to a second assembly for another vote on the floor of the assembly. So it's difficult to change the book, but it happens regularly. The confession, on the other hand, is also open to change because we recognize it's a human document, but it's like three-quarters of the first assembly, three-quarters of all the presbyteries, and three-quarters of a second assembly. It's never happened in the PCA anyway. Yeah, yeah. Well, it has been. It was changed. It was changed in America to get rid of some of the King language and stuff like that.
Okay, so the version used by the BCA.
Right.
It wouldn't be like you can't. It's not like you can't change the
original. Exactly. No. There's various versions out there. But yes, our version is open to change, but it's extremely difficult, and we've never done it. I'd actually like to see that happen on a couple of points, but. It's not going to happen in my lifetime. Pardon me? I would like to see the language on the Sabbath toned down. I mean, almost everybody that comes through for ordination takes an exception to it. That language does not represent who we are as a denomination. I think we ought to change it. I'm still a hanger-on. I'm still a six-day guy.
Struggling with that one.
But there again, we routinely give an exception to that.
Right.
So
I lean towards the 6-day literal 24, but there is some, I think, good evangelical scholars.
Oh yeah.
Who
Yeah. Well, you know, 17 years over at Severna Park with Glenn Parkinson, who was a framework guy. You know, he'd call me a dumb fundamentalist, and I'd call him a liberal. So, you know. But he was brilliant.
I think it'll be a problem for my ordination.
No. There are four categories that have historically been allowed. Certainly, 6 day is allowed, framework is allowed, day age is allowed, and then the day analogy or whatever it's called. But you have to believe in the direct creation of Adam and Eve. You know. Pardon me.
They didn't evolve from apes.
No. Right. Yeah, you have to believe in direct creation of Adam and Eve and a real fall. If you fiddle around with it beyond that, yeah. Okay. So this process of changing the book all happens, you know, through the General Assembly. They oversee all of those, you know, all of those committees. Now, when the assembly meets, and let's say it's you know, Christian Ed and Publication Committee is going to report. Now, there's a permanent committee that's been working all year, and they hire certain. I mean, there's a whole crew of people that work for CENP in Atlanta or wherever, but the permanent committee does not bring the business to the floor. When the assembly meets the day before, we have what are called committees of commissioners. In other words, guys come in from all around the country, and you can have the committee could. Have conceivably a guy from each of the presbyteries serving on it. But the budget, any recommendations, and the minutes of previous, you know, of their previous meetings and everything else are reviewed by that committee of commissioners the day before the assembly. And then when CENP is called to the floor of the assembly to report, that report is brought by the chairman of the committee of commissioners, not the permanent committee. Just another one of those check and balance kinds of things, because permanent committee wields a good bit of power throughout the year. I mean, they run their own business. So it's the people that are the watchdogs looking over it. And numerous times we've gotten recommendations from a permanent committee that a committee of commissioners say, no, we don't agree with that recommendation. And that's when you get one of those really hairy votes that to vote, you know, they're voting the denial. So to vote positively means you're turning it down. You know, it gets really confusing. So that's just an added. I've served on the committee of commissioners for Ridgehaven. I hated that one. I'll never do that one again. Numerous times I've served on interchurch relations committee. Oh, I didn't mention that one. That's a committee that interacts with other Presbyterian and Reformed denominations, trying to establish, you know, appropriate relations with them and that sort of thing. I've served on that numerous times. What did I serve on last year? I forget. It wasn't one of those. Can't remember. Doesn't matter. But it's I enjoy doing it. Now, one of the recent changes that we've done, this overture process I talked about, all of those overtures used to come before the whole assembly and everything else, and there really wasn't sufficient time given to them to debate them and that sort of thing. So we've established a couple years ago an overtures committee. It's a huge committee, 100 or so men. And all overtures, all new business now comes through that committee. They meet a day or two before. And there's no limit on debate. Now, you can have someone move, you know, calling the previous question or something, but there's no established limit. So you debate it until you're done. And then they come out with the proposal on that new piece of business. Well, I don't need to scribble on there. The assembly then votes. If you vote it up, fine, you're done. There's no substitute motions. There's no amendments that are done on the floor. All of that's done in the committee. It comes out. You either accept it. If you reject it, it gets sent back to the to that big committee to either fix it or they can just decide to trash it. But So it has helped significantly. Now, that meeting is open to any delegate to the assembly. You can go sit in on that. You know, you can sit there for hours and listen to the debate going on. You can't enter into the debate, but you can hear what's being said and that sort of thing. I actually spent a couple hours doing that last year. Got tired of seeing Mickey Mouse ears everywhere, so I went and sat in the committee. So we met at Disney World. It was the stupidest thing we ever did. Now, there's the powers of the assembly are these. To receive and issue all appeals, references, and complaints regularly brought before it from the lower courts, to bear testimony against error in doctrine and immorality in practice injuriously affecting the church, to decide all controversies respecting doctrine and discipline. Two, to give advice and instruction in conformity with the Constitution in all cases submitted to it. And often the stated clerk will do that. If you let's say a local session is struggling on how to understand the book on a certain issue, you can call the clerk's office and all it is an opinion. It's not the church authority, but he'll say, no, well, you know, he may cite a couple of cases, the church in Waxhaw did it this way kind of thing. So there's that idea of advice and instruction. To review the records of presbyteries, take care that lower courts observe the Constitution. So as our local session submits its minutes to the presbytery, each presbytery every year submits its minutes to the assembly. So someone's always looking over our shoulder, okay, to make sure that the Constitution is being followed. To devise measures for promoting the prosperity and enlargement of the church, that would be basically MNA and MTW, to erect new presbyteries and unite and divide those which were erected with their consent, and that happens almost every year. We're dividing a presbytery somewhere because it's grown to a cumbersome level, and division is desired. To institute and superintend the agencies necessary in the general work of evangelization, to appoint ministers of such labors as fall under its jurisdiction. So there again, if there's no presbyter in a certain area, the assembly can oversee that. To suppress schismatical contentions and disputations according to the rules provided therefore. There's issues before the SJC now with erroneous doctrinal issues that are being struggled with. Yeah, it dealt with Steve Wilkins before down in Louisiana, and then Peter Lighthart.
Is that Auburn Avenue?
Yeah, that was the Auburn Avenue Church. Peter Lighthart is out in Idaho. Charges are brought against him. He was sustained.
It was one person, not against an entire.
Well, we approved a statement about the Federal Vision. But then Lighthart himself was investigated by his presbytery and exonerated. That exoneration was complained against to the SJC, and that was heard, and it was sent back. It was declined and sent back to the presbytery to fix it.
Meaning the presbytery
Well, that was the opinion of the SJC, that they were wrong, and they sent it back. Now, what they do now...
what presbytery was that?
Pacific Northwest.
Okay, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
So Idaho is a part of that?
Yeah, it's a geographically huge one. Yeah. There's not many churches out there. So, okay, the rest of these are kind of redundant. How are we doing on time? Okay. You get the idea of the graded courts. Each has its particular things to do. Each has its particular geography that it deals with. And once you get to the assembly, that's as high as it goes. Now, there are some of our sub-bodies are called committees. Some are called commissions. The difference there is a committee has no authority on its own. I serve on the shepherding committee of Presbytery. We have no authority to take up business unless it's assigned to us by Presbytery. We can't rule on anything. All we can do is recommend to Presbytery, and they have to rule. A commission, on the other hand, has the authority to take up business and complete it. If it's, for instance, we use commissions to ordain guys. Instead of calling a whole big Presbytery meeting, a commission of six or seven people does an ordination. All they do is report back and submit their minutes. It's done by the commission itself. Now, if it's a judicial commission, if they're hearing a case or something like that, that has to be ratified by the Presbytery. They do the actual ruling. They find a guy guilty or not guilty, and then that report comes to Presbytery. It's voted up or down without debate. We got into an issue last Saturday at the Presbytery meeting. The language of the commission report was questioned at one particular point. Just a choice of a couple of words, and we got guy behind me stood up. He said, "Gentlemen," he said, "we are getting awfully close to debate here because you can't debate it." So I moved a 5-minute recess for the commission to reconsider its report. So they fixed it, came back, we voted it up, and we were done. But we can't, once it's voted on, you can't change it. If it's judicial commission, it's very touchy on how to deal with that. The whole issue of candidates for ministry, and I mean, there's lots of pages about that stuff. Ministers are examined and ordained by presbyteries, and there's all kinds of rules there of what he has to be examined in, what his education has to be like, and all that sort of thing. But we have a candidates committee of presbytery that interviews and examines the candidates for ministry, and then they present them to the presbytery for a vote. Now, we do very little examination on the floor of presbytery anymore. When I was ordained, there was a significant floor exam, oral exam, on the floor of presbytery. But I think over time, we began to realize that it really is tokenism. I mean, you're not going to really examine a guy on the floor of presbytery. A couple of questions are asked in a few different categories. Now, what we do now, there's still the option of asking questions. But what the guy will say is the committee examined Matt Eastman in the category of the Book of Order. We found his answers acceptable. We recommend that we arrest this portion of his exam, pending questions from the floor.
Down the Savannah River Presbytery, I went through an ordination, and they still examined from the floor. And I had actually sat in on the ordination board, is that what it's called?
The committee?
The committee.
Yeah.
And they basically asked the same questions on the floor that they had in the committee, and I was kind of thinking, this is just... I understand it's an important office, obviously, but it just seemed very redundant. And it was almost like the session was trusting the committee to have done its job well.
Right. Well, what's required? To start, you have to have a recommendation from your local session. Then you go from there to a written exam, which is extensive. From the written exam, out of any points of weakness or whatever or question, that's where a lot of your questions on the committee come from. I mean, if you answer most of your stuff straight down the line, they may not poke around in it. But if it's something like "what are what he means by that," then they start poking in that area. You also have to You have to preach before the committee. You have to write an exegetical paper. You have to write a theological paper. And then you're orally examined by the committee, and then presented to the presbytery. So there's no way we can duplicate on the floor of presbytery what the committee has already done. But we still have the option to ask some questions, and usually a few questions come out. But it's not a thorough exam on the floor of presbytery. So okay. We have musicians wanting to come in here, so let's bag this. And I'm wondering if we should end it here, because the rules of discipline. Mm-hmm. Do we want to go through that?
Well, you're not even going to be here next week, so
yeah. I mean, are you interested in understanding how trials are to be conducted and all that kind of stuff?
I find it very interesting, but it doesn't seem like the average congregant does. But anyway, it doesn't matter to me. I mean, I can study this stuff on my own. I just
take it. All right. Why don't we take next week off? You'll be back the following week, Lord willing. All right. Then we'll do rules of discipline. That following week, and then we'll be done with this section.